right place. You're listening to Radio Aryan.
This afternoon's third speaker is the editor of Morning Air magazine, Mr. David Yorkshire.
Much as well done.
Thank you very much. Well, like Richard Edmonds, I'm sort of a rather large cat, but I'm going to stand on the stage anyway. So I like to kind of wander around as I'm waffling. I was called, what was it now, I Hope Not Hate? A waffling kind of Nazi intellectual. It's very nice. Well, today, I hope I'm not going to bore you, but I am going to waffle about Ted Hughes. Ted Hughes, which is sort of appropriate in a way, because Ted Hughes was a Yorkshireman, and this is the Yorkshire Forum. But perhaps inappropriate because Ted Hughes was a committed liberal. But I'm sort of going to use Ted Hughes, as the title of this speech suggests, Ted Hughes a liberal in spite of himself, to kind of look at the liberal mindset. I remember Jim Luthwaite there said that this is what we ought to do sometimes, to have a look at them and to put them under the microscope and look at them as kind of scientists looking at bacteria. And this is what we're going to look at. Ted Hughes was born into a very traditional working class Yorkshire family, although a few of his ancestors were actually aristocratic. He was born in Mytholmroyd in the Calder Valley, not far from here, in 1930. But this traditionalism didn't stay with him. And I think it's interesting to look why. Ted Hughes was actually it's a very personal thing for me because he was one of my first influences as a writer, myself. So the first book I ever read was The Iron Man. As a small child, I was quite small actually at one time, believe it or not. But then I read his nature poetry, and later on I read his other stuff. But the later the nature poetry really interested me because there's sort of a gap, sort of a disparity between his nature poetry and the life he led as a liberal. I think that that's very interesting. And that's what I'd like to begin with. I'm going to give you a poem. This is Hawk Roosting from one of his earliest collections, Lupica. And I'm going to do it in my Yorkshire accent. I sit in the top of the wood, my eyes closed, in action, no falsifying dream between my hooked head and my hooked feet. Or in sleep rehearse perfect kills and eat. The convenience of the high trees, the air's buoyancy and the sun's ray are of advantage to me, and the earth's face upward for my inspection. My feet are locked upon the rough bark. It took the whole of creation to produce my foot, my each feather. Now I hold creation in my foot. Or fly up, and revolve it all slowly. I kill where I please because it is all mine. There is no sophistry in my body. My manners are tearing off heads. The allotment of death. For the one path of my flight is direct through the bones of the living. No arguments assert my right. The sun is behind me. Nothing has changed since I began. My eye has permitted no change. I am going to keep things like this. It's an extraordinarily powerful poem, I think, that shows both the beauty and the brutality of nature. In fact, I often say that nature has a sort of beautiful brutality, or a brutal beauty, although this is something that liberals, and I'm not talking about screaming hysterical leftists here, but just your average liberal, they think that it ought to be corrected, that somehow it's not fair and not equal. This poem is about natural hierarchy, and is, if you like, an extreme right-wing poem, because the poet becomes the high bird through the first-person narrator, and the perspective of the one becomes the perspective of the other. And Hughes came under extreme criticism for this poem. And they said that it was fascistic. Egbert Fast, for example, suggesting it was like a totalitarian genocidal dictator, which he's obviously projecting his own fantasies on here, because that's what leftists fantasize about, I think. Because the totalitarian genocidal dictatorship is sort of a guilty fetish that they have, and they project onto us. Because what they are creating is a genocidal totalitarian dictatorship. So we'll ultimately think about our genocide, the genocide of European man, if it remains unchecked. Our politicians, academics, journalists and heads of industry are all engaged in the process of bringing vast armies of people over here who do not like us. And they detest our way of life. And are prepared physically to wipe us out. For one reason or another. I mean, Richard Edmonds has suggested that it's to do with the wars that are going on in the Middle East, but that's only part of it, I think. Because this has gone on for quite some time. It predates that. And for them, the Crusades never ended. Or at least they're part of the Crusades. And if you speak to some academics as well, they will be quite frank about saying that our extinction is a good thing. Perhaps there is something of that in this poem, but the real society he's alluding to is that of the ancient Egyptians, as we see from the depiction of the sun god Ra with his hawk or falcon's head, and the sun behind it. And we have the capitalization of the word creation as well, giving it a sort of quasi-religious significance, or sort of the god-king, if you like, of the pharaoh. Gives it a religious significance. Now, this is, if you like, an extreme right-wing society. I've never heard anyone in this movement say that we should bring back a sort of Egyptian society where you have a god-king and ultimate hierarchy where the kind of lowest tier are slaves, basically. I've never heard of that. Although once I was called a fascist by a group of Antifa in Barnsley, where I had the BNP stand once. And he said, fascist, and I said to him, no, I'm more right-wing than a fascist. In the society of my choosing, you would be pulling my chariot as I whipped you down the street. And I think we would actually have both been quite satisfied with the situation, if you look at them. Now, I'm anti-democratic. I'll be open and honest about it. I don't believe in the democracies that we have now. But equally, I always believe that there should be safeguards against absolute power. Just in case, for example, someone gets the crazy notion in their heads to, I don't know, invade Poland. Just a thought. Nevertheless, I'm for a society that is based on inegalitarian principles, on natural hierarchy, on natural aristocracy, in the proper sense of the word. The aristos, the best, the rule of the best, aristocracy. Even in an extreme leftist society, though, and you notice they're always allowed to be anti-democratic, you know, if you're a communist, that's okay. Even they allege that everyone will be equal, and yet there is always a ruling clique. There is always a ruling elite. Because inequality is truth. inequality is inescapable. Paul Proofsting, the poem that I quoted, is by no means an exception. In much of his nature poetry of this time, there is the natural view, if you like, of nature. Pike is a good example, as is Crow Hill, and this stanza that I'd like to read from is from Thrushes. Terrifying are the attent, sleek thrushes on the lawn. More coiled steel than living, a poised, dark, deadly eye. Those delicate legs, triggered to stirrings beyond sense, with a start, a bounce, a stab, overtake the instant, and drag out some writhing thing. No indolent procrastinations and no yawning stares. No sighs or head scratchings. Nothing but bounce and stab and a ravening sound. I think what's interesting in both of these poems, Thrushes and Hawk Roosting, is that they're set against a backdrop of liberal society of the late 1950s. In Hawk Roosting, you have the hawk described as having no sophistry. In Thrushes, the thrush of having no indolent procrastinations. What he's critiquing here is basically the sort of liberal chattering class discourses. He's actually criticising the society that he's entering, quite bizarrely. But this is what the liberals do. They sort of engage in this self-flagellation all the time. You have, therefore, the contrast between the world of nature and the world of man as well, or at least of liberal man. And Hughes saw it this way as well, that the world of nature and the world of man are separate and distinct, and that this is a very leftist viewpoint, and there's no logic for it, actually. This is kind of a quasi-religious belief. Because, of course, we're part of nature. Why, you could only believe that we're not part of nature if there is some religious belief for that. In the most virulent forms, of course, like Marxism, the dogma is actually an attack on nature. You look at the Green Party, for example, who are allegedly there to protect our environment, and they have nothing against building on greenbelt land to accommodate the vast hordes coming in from Asia and Africa. And you realise that it's just another communist front, really. As I've said elsewhere, people who are colourblind, they often cannot see the difference between green and red, and politically neither can I.
In Bradford Council, we used to call the Greens the melons. a green skin.
Yes, that's right, green on the outside, red on the in. It's absolutely true. But equally, this man on nature split has affected people on the right of the political spectrum as well. A lot tend to go vegetarian and, you know, and campaign against hunting as well. I'm actually for hunting. I believe that hunting is a good thing. I am really right wing. I believe hunting is, obviously, you know, you have to capture food somehow. But there is also a secondary purpose of hunting, and that is to retain the killer instinct. To practice. Because some people, they say to me, on the internet, I'm going to go out there and kill these ravening hordes who are coming in and raping women and everything. Well, no, you're not, because you've not had any practice at it. And that's really what hunting was about. Both the aristocracy did that, and on a lower level, the working class of the peasantry before that, if you like. Everyone has done it. Now, interestingly, it's been a certain clique within the middle class who's tried to ban all this.
Yes.
On the left of the political spectrum, first the Whig left, the liberals, and then the socialist left. It was Labour, of course, that banned fox hunting. Equally, they've put pressure on violent sports and things like that. Boxing is always under pressure. They've tried to ban it many times. They've sort of sanitised it now, to a degree. Although, you know, there is a case for that, actually, because with the right training and everything that they have these days, they could quite easily kill each other if it weren't for the, you know, the pads in the gloves and everything that they have now. So, you know, I see that point. But even, you know, even kind of contact sports or collision sports, football is a contact sport, rugby is a collision sport, really. Even these have been sanitised over the last 20 to 30 years. In a football match in the 1980s, you know, to get sent off, you would have to take a gun out of your shorts and shoot someone. but that's what's happened. Punching went on all the time in rugby when I was playing. Don't get a face like this for nothing. These foreign elements have sort of sensed the weakening of our society, if you like. They see that we're fair game because we've become too weak, because that is nature. And they're becoming ever bolder to the point where they're now freely raping our women and children. They have no respect for us. These people still have a healthy barbarity in their own societies. And I'm not, don't get me wrong, I despise halal and kosher slaughter, because I think that that leads to another sort of unnatural mindset, where basically you delight in the cruelty of the thing, you know, because to actually watch that is, you know, it leads to another form of perversion in my belief. Now, Ted Hughes recounts that in childhood, he hunted the small creatures in the countryside, around his home, capturing them, collecting them, which was a common enough pursuit for young children. His brother Gerald as well, he became a gamekeeper, which, to be a gamekeeper, you also have to have a very healthy respect for and realistic view of nature. But then Hughes says, and I'll quote him, "At the age of 15, my life grew more complicated and my attitude to animals changed. I accused myself of disturbing their lives. I began to look at them, you see, from their point of view." That is a very interesting quotation, I think. He did essentially what liberals always do. He put himself in the position of the other. And this, if you read liberal philosophers like John Stuart Mill, he always goes on about adopting the position of the other, seeing it from their perspective. But you can't do that. You can't do that. You can only see the world from your own perspective. It is impossible to put yourself in another's shoes, because all you're doing really is imprinting, projecting, if you like, your own personality on them. What you believe, they believe. And it's interesting because liberals always believe that everyone else is liberal. This is the reason for it. They're just like me, because they're projecting their own personality onto them. And it's, you know, it kind of assumes omnipresence, doesn't it, really, and omnipotence, and, you know, all these things. Yes, James?
It's a classic philosophical debate, and go on for years. It's called If I Were a Horse.
Yes.
You try to imagine what it's like to be a horse. But
yes.
Of course, you can't.
That's right, exactly. You cannot be a horse, and you have no idea, truly, how a horse thinks. You can imagine that you do, but it's just imagination. It is perhaps not, perhaps it is true, perhaps it's not. You will never, ever know. But liberals assume that they do know. And they assume that everyone else is liberal. And that's why when they get sort of anti-liberal views coming from someone, they can't handle it. They break down. And they sort of either go into these hysterical fits, or they ignore it. and they completely blank off and cut off. So that's really kind of the liberal mindset, if you like. But the question begs, why did Ted Hughes go from being a normal, healthy child to being liberal? Well, I think the age he mentions is quite key to understanding that. 15. Adolescence. At that age, he'd already been through 10 years of education. Firstly through primary school, and then particularly through grammar school. It's no secret that Hughes was unusually close to his teachers. In fact, if truth be known, he was a bit of a teacher's pet. He was mentored at Mixford Grammar School in South Yorkshire by a Mr. Fisher, because you didn't, in those days, you didn't know the first names, did you? They're just Mr. whatever.
Sir.
But, oh, sir, yes, indeed. But his name was actually John Fisher, but anyway. Now, I'd say that he had a liberal education. But the fact is that all state education has been liberal since the very beginning. The liberals were the people behind the Elementary Education Act in, 1871, wasn't it? And they were members of the Liberal Party, the people who campaigned for that. Chief among them, Joseph Chamberlain, George Dixon, Jesse Collins, and William Forster, and it's often called the Forster Act. And this, it was really based on, again, the philosophy of John Stuart Mill, who wanted a standardized education for everyone, and had written on the subject a few years prior to that. Well, the main reasons liberals gave for introducing the Act was that Britain was lagging behind in manufacturing and economic power, as especially Prussia, soon to be the United Germany, had already instituted an education program, and they said that we were lagging behind them. We often forget that capitalism comes from the old left of liberalism, of Whiggism, and not from the right. The Tories, the Conservative Party, they've adopted it. That's right. They were for the aristocratic, the agricultural class of society, for the farmers, for the aristocrats. That was what the original Tories were for. The Whigs were for the progressives in every sense of the word. Progressive in ideology as well as progressive in science. And things like that. So, in some ways, you know, it was good. But in others, it has had a deep psychological effect on us, I think, and a negative one. Now, one of the major concerns raised against state education was that children would be indoctrinated into liberal thought. And that has proved to be absolutely correct.
Yeah.
I remember when I was at school, and that was under Thatcher, who was allegedly right-wing, but nothing of the sort. In actual fact, we had To Kill a Mockingbird, so we could talk about what happened to the oppressed blacks in America. We had Walkabout, so we could talk about how poor the Aborigines in Australia were. We had short stories by Kafka and A Kid for Two Farthings, so we could talk about anti-Semitism and how hard it was to be Jewish. And funnily enough, we actually had to do a stage play of To Kill a Mockingbird. And I got to play the prosecutor, bizarrely, which art sort of foreshadows real life in a way, you know. That's quite amusing. One of the things we also had to watch was a miniseries which came out in the 80s called Shoah. Hughes, of course, growing up during World War II, got wartime propaganda firsthand at school. Much to the delight of his biographer, Elaine Feinstein. Yes. What you had then under liberal education was a systematic indoctrination program of relentless pity and sympathy and preference for the other. And don't forget that this liberalism paved the way for the extreme left and their cultural revolution of the 1960s. because liberal education is indoctrination against your natural instincts. If you look at the people leftists call intellectual or cultured or whatever, they are always people who can rationalise against that which we know to be right instinctively. Yep. It's no coincidence that the opposite of right is both left and wrong. Leftists talk about nature versus nurture, the nature versus nurture debate. I remember a former sociology teacher telling me that the difference between the left and the right is that the right believes in nature, and on the left, we are on the nurture side of the debate, and that man is a product of his environment and upbringing, and that his characteristics are not inborn. But this is actually a false dichotomy altogether, because as I've said before, nurture arises from nature. It is natural to look after one's young. And it is done instinctively in the animal kingdom and in us. What the left is, in all its guises, is anti-nature. They are really the reactionaries. They are reacting against nature. Because their vision of nurture is to stamp on that part of man which is inborn. And equally, they are anti-nurture because they wish to nurture the other against their own group. Because they believe that their own group is the worst. But that means doing everything but nurturing your own family, which is totally unnatural. In the most extreme case of communism, for example, they are specifically ideologically against the family, against one's nearest and dearest. And they talk to us about hate and label us the haters. But even liberals, while not ideologizing it in quite so crude a way, go along with it. I had a colleague once at college, just an ordinary run-of-the-mill liberal in her 50s, and she said to me, quite bluntly, "I'm glad I never have children, because I think it's a good thing that we die out as a race." She said those very words. And I said to her, "Then you must be mentally ill." I don't have that job anymore. This sort of nihilism is very common among liberals because one generation invariably affects the next through the liberal education system. Ted Hughes himself was a teacher for a while, and as his biographer Elaine Feinstein confirms in her own words, she says, this is on page 70, "When they returned to Cambridge, Ted continued to work in the secondary modern school. He was a naturally good teacher, and boys who were often eager to leave school and earn some more money responded with an unexpected enthusiasm to his reading of Auden's ballads. A liberal head teacher gave him the freedom to educate the children in general knowledge, particularly the history of the Russian Revolution, the rise of the Nazis in Germany, and what happened to the Jews." Not like a Jewish writer, is it, to mention Jewish interests? And, you know, it goes on. This is, what, page 30? Most of Hughes' closest friends were made in his second and third years at university, among them undergraduates who had come up to college later than he did, as was the case with Daniel Weisbord, 5 years his junior, a curly-haired Londoner of Belgian Jewish descent. Weisbord came up in 1953 to read history, although he changed to economics, blah, 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 blah. And page 60. Let's have a look at page 60. Page 62. He spent May and June at Alexander House while Sylvia read Plato and wrote essays for Dorothea Crook, a personable young Jewish fellow of Newham who was warm and generous towards her, because Jews are always warm and generous, of course. page 101. Because it goes on and on. I'll just give you another couple of quotes. Ted realised that Alvarez was quite different from himself, quintessentially North London Jewish, academically sharp and streetwise. Both academically sharp and streetwise, of course. Page 179. That's also quite interesting. 179. Now happy in his marriage to Carol, Hughes travelled with her as part of a group of English poets, including Dennis Enright, Peter Porter and Danny Abser, who were visiting Israel for the first time. Danny observed that Hughes got on a plane with a tiger's foot in his pocket, which evidently gave the security guards on the Israeli airline, El Al, some problems. As Danny remembered, Hughes had enormous authority, even then, although he was several years younger than the other poets apart from Porter. And this is a quotation from Danny Abser. When we were squabbling about who read first and you'd read last, he said, "You will read first, you will read second, you will read fourth." And they all accepted it. So he had an authoritative presence even then. And obviously, even earlier than before I knew him. He was very pro-Israel, and I remember him saying to me that he wouldn't give 1 yard, 1 inch back to the Arabs. In fact, I learned probably more about Elaine Feinstein than I did about Ted Hughes during the reading of that. Even sort of the description of Hughes and his family are very much Judeo-centric. Edith, that's his mother, was handsome and immensely capable. She had olive skin, the hair of a red Indian, and strong features. Her three children, to judge from photographs, took their good looks from her, although Alwyn had fair hair as a child, and Ted's was brown rather than black. So, there you go. Olive skin, black hair good, blonde hair bad. You notice that? And there's no end to the chutzpah here, because isn't that what the Jews accuse us of? Of being extremely ethnocentric. And don't they say that our ethnocentrism is morally wicked? This is, of course, projection, but then projection itself is quintessentially Jewish, isn't it? And it comes from Freudian theory. It comes from Freud's letters to Wilhelm Fleiss, who was also Jewish. But projection itself is a projection. It is the Jews saying that we project our fears, our anxieties, our desires and motivations onto others, when in fact, that's exactly what they do. Freud's theory did not take much discovering, because he just looked inwardly and then projected the theory onto us. Actually, if we were as ethnocentric as they say we are, our race would not be in the precarious position it's in. I don't criticize what she's doing. Actually, I think that we should be doing exactly the same thing, and when we write books, it should be truthful, far more truthful than this. But it should, it should be honest. But equally, it should be done from our perspective. But the chutzpah is that Elaine Feinstein praises Hughes for being a liberal, while remaining what she would call, if she were a Gentile, a right-wing extremist. In some ways, she's the Jewish equivalent of one of us. But that is always the way with these people, isn't it? Nationalism for me, but not for thee. She also makes him out to be a strong authoritarian figure, as I said in that quotation there. But liberalism is actually a position of weakness. In her descriptions of him at school, for example, she describes him as an athletic, and a good discus thrower, bringing in sort of Greco-Roman archetypal image, which was also used by the National Socialists, by the way, and that he was quite popular. Now, Elaine Feinstein was not at school with Ted Hughes, but my grandmother was. And she remembers quite a different Ted Hughes. As I've said before, he was a bit of a teacher's pet. He was quite aloof from the other boys, a bit of a loner, and quite gangly and lanky. Was it this physical awkwardness that led him towards being a liberal? Perhaps there have been studies that show that physically strong people tend to be more right-wing. I don't know. One thing is true of Feinstein's account, though, although she overplays it as usual, and that is that Hughes attracted Jews to him almost as though they could smell his liberalism, really. It didn't help that Hughes' family were Methodists, one of the most Judaist forms of Christianity. Feinstein, in fact, writes with glee of them attending the Methodist Zion Chapel, while simultaneously deconstructing and denouncing their Puritanism. These early formations of the young Hughes were to set him up for the disaster of his adult life. We saw him have two doomed relationships, one to a Jewess, Assia Weevil, and the other to his wife, the writer Sylvia Plath, both of whom killed themselves. Both in the same manner, actually. They stuck their heads in the oven with the gas on. Assia also killed her daughter, who may or may not have been Ted's. But isn't it an extraordinary irony that Assia killed herself and her daughter in such a way, you know, oven, gas. remember what I said about projection? Sylvia Plath was a living disaster of a woman. She'd already attempted suicide, had psychotherapy, electric shock therapy, for mental illness before she met Ted. And she kept that from him. Because, of course, all leftists have no commitment to truth. Marx says categorically, there are no eternal truths. But even the liberal comes from the Benthamite tradition, this is from Jeremy Bentham, that says the greatest good is the greatest pleasure. Well, if the greatest pleasure is achieved by the hiding of the truth, or the telling of a lie, then that is the greatest good and is moral. People wonder how the media, for example, which is all of varying degrees of the left, can be so blatant about, you know, lying about us and the reasons for the immigration that's going on as well, and the immigrants themselves. It's because the journalists who all go through these Marxist brainwashing camps, known as universities, have all been sold an idea, a dream, a utopian vision of the future, which does not include the white man, who is irredeemably evil and must be done away with for the good of humanity. This is the nihilism of which Nietzsche foretold. Plath was mentally ill and suffered from chronic depression, and the poetry reflects this. I haven't brought any to read because I don't want anyone hanging themselves in the toilet. but this is what liberals and Marxists and feminists and all the rest of the left love and masturbate over. Plath is hailed as a feminist icon, and yet she certainly had nothing to do with feminism and was content to get married and have children. But yet feminists use her suicide as proof of the evils of the patriarchal society, when in fact her mental instability was exacerbated by the liberal social structures that were already in place, where promiscuity is a social norm. Ted Hughes was having an affair with Assia Weevil at the time, who was married to David Weevil, and who bore a child that could have been either Ted or David's. And then when Sylvia was dead, he discarded Assia and moved in with Carol Orchard, who was many years younger than him, and whom he married. So you have these kind of strange, complex relationships which are utterly disastrous. And this is not to say that Sylvia Plath was a saint. She could be extremely vindictive and would often write real people as caricatures in her work. Her only novel, The Bell Jar, I would sum up as office gossip. Some of her poetry is barely disguised arguments between her and Ted. This is the origin of the very famous quotation that's used, every woman loves a fascist. It's actually directed against Ted. As regards her poetry, as with Ted, it's free verse. That is, poetry allegedly without structure. At its worst, really, it's merely chopped up bits of prose. Elaine Feinstein says of Ted that he always found the right word for the right occasion. Well, That's not good enough, to be quite honest. Gustave Flaubert was talking about that in the 19th century, but he was talking about the novel. So you can see that poetry has degenerated to the novel, and the novel has degenerated into gossip. So it's quite quantifiable that the arts have, you know, degenerated. One of the reasons for this is that Ted determined earlier on, as did Sylvia, to earn a living as a writer, as a poet in Ted's case. But that means subserving the interests of the liberal, far left, and foreign cliques in power. And art should not be prostituted like that. That is my belief. It should be honest and true. And it's that which I try to collect in Mjolnir magazine. The third issue I picked up yesterday and brought some today. And no one gets paid. I don't get paid. The artists don't get paid. They do it for the love of art, of culture, and their own people. Certainly, Ted Hughes's poetry, it became sort of more multiculturalist as time went on. Not overtly so, but, for example, in Crow, the poetic collection, you sort of get bits of Freudianism, bits of Jung, bits of Amerindian mythology, and so on, kind of all mushed together. Well, that's not, in my view, really deep. And that is, again, typically liberal, where they can sort of, you know, have a Ganesh, a picture of Ganesh hanging above, you know, their mantelpiece, and they can have a little statue of Buddha, and so on and so forth. It's a very superficial attitude to culture. But you see in Ted Hughes's nature poetry, you know, some of which I've just read, glimpses of what could have been, really. Imagine, for example, if he'd had me as a schoolmaster, things would have been very different.
They clipped him round the ear for a start.
Yes, he would have certainly had a very different life and career to the one he had. And I believe a far more positive one. Couldn't have, you know, he couldn't have got much worse than the life that he led, to be honest. And that's something we have to be looking at, to educating our own. And we are, after all, responsible for our own children. And this must be done as part of a serious attempt to create the parallel structures for an alternative to society to the one that is decaying around us. I'm not really concerned about it now because, you know, this will destroy itself. You know, people are worried about what is happening now, but that will all destroy itself. What you need to do is to create something that will replace it. And, you know, theirs is essentially a death cult, really. Mm. It really is. It is the process of self-annihilation. And so, and this goes out to all those listening on YouTube, other websites or media. You have a choice to make. You can remain with the dying, atrophying, diseased society in its degenerate and decaying culture and die with it. Or you can join us and join something truly vibrant and vitalist. And I have actually received quite a lot of material from people who were in the mainstream, and they've said, you know, from artists within the mainstream, and they've said, I'm fed up of it. I'm sick of it. I want in. I want to be part of what you're doing. Okay. And so, I say to these people, come over. Help us to create a living, breathing, organic culture for our children, for our children's children, and their children, for tomorrow and beyond.
Well done.
Got any questions for Dave at all?
Silence!
I've either done a very good job or a very bad
one. Okay, Ted Hughes is your student. Think back, you're his teacher. What would be the top 10 books you'd have to read? First 10 books you could read.
Top 10 books? The Philosophy of Thomas Carlyle. I think he's up there. Julius Evola as well. Christopher Marlowe. What else? Chaucer, of course. Absolutely Chaucer. Dickens. And Charles Kingsley. And Thomas Inglesby, although not many people know of him.
Legends, yeah.
That's right, Inglesby, yes. Absolutely. Wow. Very educated man.
You haven't mentioned Shakespeare in the Bible yet.
Tennyson. I'm not a Christian, I would include the Bible, actually. I would include the Bible. Because, like it or not, a large part of Western culture stands upon the Bible. And if you don't know your Bible, you don't know a lot about the culture that followed it. So you have to have that in there.
Like the extermination of the Amalekites.
Like, yes, indeed, yeah. And the Ammonites and the Amorites and the Philistines. And so on, yes. It's worth reading our enemies as well as the... You know, as the people who are on our side. Did I mention Tennyson?
Tennyson? Yep, we've got Tennyson. One more book to film.
One more book, then it has to be Milton. So, even though Milton was very odd, to be honest, in his belief system, and very Judaized, actually. If you read his political, it's political and theological mixed together. So, you know, if you read those papers, they're very interesting. And it also shows you the mindset of the Puritans that left for America. And the reason why America is how it is and sort of dedicated to Israel. So that is very, very interesting to look at, actually.
Well, Tom's got a question here.
Right, two questions. The first one is, you talked about halal slaughter.
Yes.
And how this is different from, say... Combative sports. I would agree with you that the enjoyment you get from slaughtering animals and watching combative sports is different. But what would you say is the underlying difference, the definitional difference, which makes those separate? And the other question is to do with the rules. I mean, rulesian ideas, you know, social contract, veil of ignorance, right? You put everyone else in other people's shoes, right? I mean, I've actually got a university discussion on that in about a week's time. So, you know, the fundamental flaw on that, right... As far as you see it, and as far as I see it as well, right, is that's a sort of metaphysical impossibility. Not really possible to do that, and that's the flaw you would attack.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, fantastic. And the other question, by the way.
And the other question, yes, which was on halal slaughter. The thing about halal slaughter is it's ritualized. It is unnatural. It is essentially, I don't know if you've ever seen halal slaughter, have you?
It's not something I watch on the
spectrum. No.
Fortunately, yeah.
That's right. It is essentially, you slit the throat and then you watch the animal suffer for several minutes. And then it is in extreme distress. To delight in that is not natural. With hunting, we have, the chase is natural. It is part of nature. And it has a chance to escape. And don't forget, people talk about fox hunting, and say that it's cruel and barbaric and everything. Well, what about what a fox does to a chicken? It's part of nature. But the fox, it doesn't delight kind of, it doesn't kind of torment it or anything. Kills it. because it's his nature, and it is equally our nature to have that hunter's instinct. And we've lost it to an extent, and this has been part of the weakness of the West, that we've become too passive and too philosophical. You know, Hughes's poem talks about sophistry, and that is what we've become. We've become sophists. I believe in both the mind, the spirit, and the body, all working together with no contradiction. I don't separate them. That is a very Christian idea. I'm a pagan, and that is why essentially I'm a pagan, because I can't. I don't separate, you know, the mind, the spirit, and the body. It all works and all functions together.
I'd like to make
I personally think that this delight in cruelty and everything has unbalanced the Arab and Jewish mind. Although if you look at the two cultures, they're very similar because they're both submissive peoples. And I sincerely hope that they'll fall right back there.
I'd mention that one of the reasons that farmers hate foxes so much is because they do actually extend this. What they do, if a fox gets into a hen hen house, they don't just kill one. Yeah. They just keep on going.
Yeah.
It pulls the bits off. It doesn't kill them all. It pulls the bits off.
Yeah.
All of them. It leaves them half alive.
While it's tormenting the mouse. And the best theory is...
That is true. A cat plays.
Yeah. So the theory is that... and I don't know if it's true, but this is the theory. That what the cat is doing is terrifying the mouse. And in fact, cannibals have done this as well. There's an account on the website somewhere. what they would do is chop off a leg of the slave, and then put him in the river and store him. The river was like the deep freeze.
Yeah.
But the idea was that he should suffer because it improves the quality of the meat, the taste of the meat.
There is a reason to kosher and halal slaughter.
Mm.
There is a reason to... The reason is religious.
It's codified in religion.
Yeah. Mm. No, but it's specified that the primary reason is religious. No, to tenderize, to kind of tenderize the meat or whatever, that is a perfectly natural thing to do. It is natural. There is a point to it. But to kind of watch an animal suffer...
That's what I don't like about cats and foxes too. But I should point out that these things do exist in nature.
They do. But do they do it because they enjoy the cruelty?
They do it out of instinct. Instinct has come from somewhere.
Yes, but again, do they do it through cruelty or not? You know, do they enjoy the cruelty? Again, you can't possibly know because you cannot put yourself in the shoes of a fox. That's right.
Okay. Do
foxes
wear shoes? Anyway.
Following the green shirt.
No, that was it. That was the same point that Simon made.
Question from Jim.
I believe that's true of why Chinese and other Southeast Asian peoples deliberately treat dogs in particular cruelly before they eat them. Is again, there's the widespread belief that if a dog suffers, the meat will taste better.
Yeah, it's some kind of stress hormone that goes into the muscles.
Yeah, something like that. It acts as a tenderizer.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that with regard to foxes, the only explanation I've seen given is that the fox doesn't perceive chickens as individuals insofar as we can enter into the minds of foxes. It just responds automatically to a lot of fluttering wings. As far as it's concerned, any sort of fluttering, moving thing would kill.
But the chickens are trapped, that's why normally they fly away.
Yes, that's not a natural set of affairs. In a state of nature, when would a fox encounter a whole group of chickens trapped inside a cage? It wouldn't, because they'd all run away.
Yeah.
Man conveniently puts them together, the fox, insofar as we can enter into the mind of foxes, and think, wow, Christmas has come early this year. Some kind person has put all these chickens together in one coop so I can go and slaughter them.